Today's episode of Tim Blackett and Friends is brought to you by Grandview Drive, a collection of short fiction written by me, Tim Blackett, a book which Emily Austin says is compelling, moving, shocking, disturbing, and sharp, a violently great read that will zap you like a 4,000-pound defibrillator. The book is found anywhere books are sold in Canada, and coming up on April 4th, it will be available anywhere worldwide.
A one, two, three, four. Tim Blackett, baby, dabba doo, deep, deep, bop, bopba doo, ribbit, deep, deep, bop, dabba doo, bop, deep, deep, bop, bopba doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 bop, bopba doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 deep. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, 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 bop. Tim Blackett, baby, deep, tip, 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 tip. Blackett, tip, Blackett, Tim Blackett and Friends.
Shortly after I got word that Knightwood Editions wanted to publish my book, Grandview Drive, I went to their catalog to find a few titles I could read to get better acquainted with the type of work they were publishing. And after flicking through the titles for a minute, I chose Connor Kerr's book, mostly because it also took the name of a street, the Avenue of Champions, as its title. And as I made my way through the book, two things happened pretty much simultaneously. One, I felt an immense pride in my work being published alongside Connor Kerr's. But two, I felt an unmistakable bout of imposter syndrome coming on. The book seemed to be so clear in its vision and so concise in its execution that I started thinking my book wasn't ready. I needed to tighten things up to think harder about what I wanted to say. And through the editing process, I tried to polish it to get it up to Knightwood's and to Connor Kerr's level. In addition to the novel, Kerr has published a collection of poetry, Old Gods, and his follow-up novel, Prairie Edge, is due to release on April 16th, next month. After finishing his first novel, I borrowed Old Gods from the library, and I found I needed to spend more time with it, so I've since purchased and devoured my own copy. And when I found out about Prairie Edge, I reached out to his publicist for an ARC, which they were gracious enough to send my way. Kerr has a unique voice that has pulled through all three books, able to speak to profound systemic issues plaguing so-called Canadian reality, with a tone that is sometimes playful and hopeful, and other times frustrated, even angry at the glacial pace of change and reconciliation in Canada. His characters and narrators go from inspired hope for change to somber and downcast, unwilling to accept the status quo on one hand, while recognizing that the same status quo is resilient and reluctant to let go of its position of power, to put it mildly. The result is three books that show the reader ways in which change is possible, even inevitable, without any of the false and fluffy pretense or performance of the current systems and structures of Canada. Avenue of Champions was shortlisted for the Amazon Canada First Novel Award, longlisted for the 2022 Giller Prize, and won the 2022 Relit Award. Old Gods was a finalist for the Governor General's Award in Canada, and in 2022, he was named as one of CBC's writers to watch. With Prairie Edge releasing next month, there's no doubt in my mind that Connor Kerr will be considered amongst some of the most important contemporary letterers and voices in Canadian literature for years to come. Connor is a Métis Ukrainian writer living in Edmonton, a member of the Métis Nation of Alberta. He is descended from Lac Ste. Anne Métis and the Papas Chase Cree Nation. He is currently an assistant professor at the University of Alberta, where he teaches creative writing. Connor Kerr, welcome to Tim Blackett and Friends.
Man, what an introduction there. I think I'm blushing over here. That was great. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, I've been looking.
It's an honor to be here. Yeah.
I've been looking forward to this interview for quite a while. I know I emailed you last year, and then it's taken a while to get to meet up, but yeah.
Yeah, I love talking with guys from, everyone from Saskatchewan too, because, you know, it's just home province and home territories there on the prairies. And yeah, I was just showing my friend all these, you know, photos from like northern Saskatchewan going canoeing, as well as like the southern prairie bird hunting, like Buffalo Pound, where I grew up as a kid, and Moose Jaw and all those good spots in Saskatoon. Yeah. So fun. Yeah.
I really appreciated seeing, especially in your poetry collection, talking about Buffalo Pound in the area. I haven't spent a ton of time there, but my kid's mom lives in a place called Parkview, which is just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So I drive there to pick them up sometimes, and yeah, I get to see Buffalo Pound and stuff. It was just interesting to see the connections, even though...
Yeah, totally.
We don't
really
love each other, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start where I very often start these interviews and just talk about what has sort of propelled you into writing, what has drawn you to this writing life, and when did you sort of know... you would be a writer, that sort of thing.
Sure. I've been doing this since I was a little kid. Like I used to go to all the little writing camps, like all of those things when I was young. I was a big library nerd, doing the whole like library book clubs back in the day, and trying to get as many like of those like reading prizes as possible so you could win like the individual like pizzas from school and that kind of thing. But I've always been drawn to storytelling. I come from a family of storytellers, like you hang out with my granny, who is a very prominent character in Avenue of Champions, or like a version of her, or you hang out with my uncles or even my like grandfather on my Ukrainian side, and like they're all telling stories constantly, and it's just like it's a constant storytelling kind of process. And I grew up in a space where I'm, very comfortable in that, doing the same kind of thing. And I also remember being a little kid and thinking about some of my grandmother's stories and how I was worried about like the continuation of those and what that looks like to try to like capture and retain a sensibility of what it really means to be, a Métis person growing up on the prairies in a certain time and aspect. Because I'm sure you might relate to this as well, but like when I was younger, like I didn't none of the writing that I was reading really like spoke to me at all. Like I didn't see myself reflected in any of it. Like I loved what I was reading, but like none of it was prairie literature whatsoever. Like I think some of the only stuff that was written, like it wasn't until like, I think I read like a Thomas King book back in the day, was like the one of the first ones where I was like, whoa, like that's like I kind of get the way that people are telling stories in this, and this like more of this like circular arc. So I was really interested in like trying to figure out how to write some of our own stories. And I remember being at a writing thing back when I was like maybe in like grade 8 or 9, even younger than that probably. And I wrote the story out, and I wrote it out the way my grandmother tells it, and I thought it was and I love the story. I wrote it out, and then the lady who was running the camp accused me of plagiarism. She was like, there's no way, and like why would you accuse like a 12-year-old of that to begin with? But she was like, there's no way you wrote that story, blah 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 blah, like you can't be doing that. And I was just like, and I remember just being like shocked, but then also at the same time being like, screw her, I'm going to continue to like do this and write out my own like stories in this way. And honestly, I've never really stopped. So now, I'm in my mid-30s, and it's been a lot of years of writing at this point, that's for sure.
I do relate to first, I want to clarify. I don't know. I'll say this. I am not indigenous. Many people think I am.
Yeah, I don't even think it like it's in, honestly, it's like growing up in the prairies, like in like the prairie-based literature. Like
That's what I was gonna say, is where I relate to what you're saying is it being here and thinking myself of as a writer and a creative type person in Regina for a very long time. I felt really sort of isolated, and I didn't recognize that there were other people who were doing the same or similar things and right like creating here. I felt really alone as an artist or a writer.
Totally.
But it's only been recently in the last 5 or 6 years where I've really connected with other writers and other storytellers here, and even read books that are situated in Regina or Saskatoon or whatever. Like I think the connections are really, at least for me, sort of building. And even throughout Alberta and Manitoba and stuff, I'm recognizing that there are these prairie writers that have something to say about our life here, which is cool for
I
me.
think that's like a, it's a very burgeoning, like not burgeoning, like there's been people doing it for a while now, obviously, but I feel it's like been kind of isolated within like the Canadian like scope of literature, and where, the main focal points are still very much based out of like Toronto and the East, where like this dictation of like what makes Canadian literature, which is of course bullshit, because a lot of great literature comes out of the regional like areas. And you think about like the quality of writing coming out of Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Alberta these days, or the prairies and the different treaty areas there, and it's like astounding. Like I know like you've chatted with like my buddy Jessica Johns and like others, and like they're like, like I think I feel the same way about Edmonton, and it's like kind of literary scene and how it's building up. Like I feel like honored to like chat with like a Niska writer like Jordan Abel, who lives there. Jordan and I go, chat all the time. Matthew Weigel wrote a book like White Mud Walking, Emily Riddle, The Big Melt, like Jessica Johns with Bad Cree. Like we all hang out and are able to work through these like kind of literary like not the conventions, but like just have those discussions about what makes like the literature that we're trying to produce within these spaces, which is pretty cool.
I'd like to sort of begin with Avenue of Champions. Like I've said, I've just found it to be sort of brilliant in form, the ways it brings so many different perspectives to one larger story. And I wondered if you could speak to that form a little bit. In the acknowledgments, you mentioned that many of the chapters were published on their own as stories. So I was wondering, was it your intention to write a novel when beginning this, or was it short stories that you sort of at one point figured out these go together and it's going to be a larger thing? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, 100% they're all short stories. I actually, like, the novel idea came out of, because that's the only way they were going to publish it. Was like if they could frame it like a novel. Yeah. Because and I got this from, like, I sent that book to everyone, and I mean every publishing house, every agent, with an open call, like absolutely anyone I could send it to, and I didn't hear back from anyone except for like one or two people, and they were basically like, we don't want it, the short stories, maybe if it's a novel, or if you read a novel, maybe send that to us, but until then, like, don't worry about it. It's just, or like, not, we're not interested in this book. And then my friend, Dr. Norma Dunning, an incredible Inuit writer, she sent it over to Douglas and McIntyre, who then published it through Nightwood Editions, and that worked out. But then we formulated into the idea of a novel from these different short stories. I've always loved the idea of connected short stories, though, to like frame something. Like, you know, when you get those kind of like little Easter eggs where you're reading a short story and there's like a slight reference to another like character or short story that's like within the collection, and you're like, oh, I get it, because I know who that character is based on reading this other one here. And I mean, at the time, like, I was really just trying to build up a little bit of a literary CV in publishing these like pieces, kind of individually, or submitting them for contests, trying to make some like cash doing that. And but a lot of the book, like, the kind of, it began with the story that begins it all, The Last Big Dance. And I wrote that in a class for Marilyn Dumont, made great, incredible Métis poet, when I was trying to upgrade to get into the MFA program at UBC. And I remember when I wrote that story and I'm chatting with her all about it, she's like, oh, you got something here. Like, you know, this is something that you can like really build around. And I wanted to, at the same time, like really capture a bit of my family's history and living in those like road allowance communities north of St. Paul, Alberta, after the dissolution of the Papas Chase for Cree Nation in Edmonton back in the 1880s. And like the experience of my grandmother's grandmother, and then even her growing up in that. And obviously it's fictionalized, like it's a fictional book, but the idea of that space remains the same. And so trying to formulate that inevitably into what would, you know, and then at some point during the editing process, like it was very easy to kind of link them all together into a novel. As a writer, though, you know, of course, going back now, I see more ways that I could have edited it and made it more of an easy kind of like transition. Like I think of the ending of Avenue of Champions, and I'm like, I wish I did more on the ending. You know, like I think that's a glaring omission within that book. But obviously, as a writer, you know, you're never going to get, you got to, at some point, you got to let go. Yeah.
Yeah. My collection too is connected short stories, but they felt that they weren't connected enough to make it a novel. So it's, the title page is Grandview Drive, a novel struck through, short stories struck through, and then fiction.
Nice. Yeah.
And in the those same way,
bending.
Yeah. At least I like to think so. I'm pretty, yeah. But like you were saying, there's reading it through now. It's a real thing out in the world, and I'm really proud of it, right? But there's so many other bits that I'm like, man, I should have wrote another story to include that character or something like that. But
totally. Yeah. Maybe, when's your book coming out?
Oh, it came out in November last year.
Okay, cool. I need to get a copy of that unit.
Yeah. And I guess its release date in the States is November 4th or something. So
who's publishing in the States?
I think it's just Nightwood. I don't know why there's a different, I don't know why it was a different release date or whatever. And I know there are people that I talked to in the States that already have copies. So maybe they just ordered it from wherever, but people there want the book and they're like, it's not even available in America or in the UK or whatever.
I'm
like,
yeah, well,
you got to wait till April. So
yeah, the joys of publishing.
Yeah.
Man, my grandparents lived on Grandview Drive in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. back in the day.
Yeah, I tell this all the time, but when I was writing it, in my head, I thought I invented this street name. Like, I know it's pretty generic, but
Yeah, totally.
yeah,
Yeah.
I've had people from Moose Jaw tell me they live there, and there's
Yeah.
one in BC outside of Vancouver or something, and then there's
Oh,
even,
there's one in Edmonton. Yeah.
oh yeah, there's
Yeah.
one in
Grandview
Ill
Heights. Sorry. Yeah.
oh
Yeah.
in Illinois. It's like a sort of pilgrimage spot with lots of foliage, and people go there just to take pictures of stuff. So I've got people,
Okay.
I've
Yeah.
been to Grandview Drive in Illinois, but it is what it
Nice.
is.
Totally. That's fun.
So then, Avenue of Champions is a novel and stories, and then you've written poetry, two collections. Is that right? Explosion of
Yeah,
Colors.
too. And that's I call it emo cowboy juvenilia shit though.
Okay.
Like it's very it's like mainly, same thing. Dr. Norma Dunning, incredible person, helped me get that out. And she was publishing poetry through this one press, and they took this manuscript, and it was essentially like a lot of just I collected poems from, like 20 to like 28 or 27, and a lot of it. There's like one section around these magpies that I really like, and outside of that, the rest of them are like kind of crappy poems. Métis Magpie or something like that. Yeah, so an explosion of feathers, I kind of just write off. I hope it like I don't even think it's available anywhere. Like it, I'm hoping that at one point it'll be like this funny like collector's item almost, where like people are
Yeah.
like weirdly like trying to find these random copies of that book that's out there. Like I don't even think I have a copy of it right now. And then yeah, Old Gods. And Old Gods is a bit more like refined. I mean, a lot of my themes are pretty similar, where we're talking about like land back, talking about like a switch to like indigenous governance structures within these places, what it looks like to be living in a contemporary indigenous life within the prairies, in my case particularly like in Edmonton, living in a space that your family's called like home for since time immemorial. And in a lot of Old Gods, we talk about this like, and I guess Avenue of Champions has it as well, with like that connection back into a space where, that is concrete, like city that's built over the spot, but like the ground holds, the blood, the tears, the laughter, the joy of your ancestors since time immemorial, and how what it means to be so like intrinsically connected into an area. And so, in Old Gods, there's a lot of I think there's a lot of anger in that book in particular. And I mean, Avenue of Champions does too. If you look at like that very back, like the acknowledgments, it's like quite angry, and I feel that's where I'm like trying to get out a lot of that anger as well as in that writing. I'm just trying to like figure out my own place within these spaces as well, because I think that contemporary existence is very interesting, because a lot of people, they want the token indigenous person. They want someone who is bringing, like what like neoliberal people in the suburbs of the Canadian cities want to see, like the like, oh, look at these beads, aren't they pretty? Oh, there's like a beautiful feather. Like they want this like stereotypical imagery of who Indigenous peoples are. And actually, I tell my classes at U of A this, when we talk about like breaking and defining like and destroying tropes around like Indigenous characters, like, and I think in particularly the grandmother in Avenue of Champions, and the way that she is, like she's like for all intents, she's an elder. Like, and so and mo lots of the ways that like Western literature tropes want to see an Indigenous elder is like they want her, like doing ceremony, and everything she says is wise, and like it's all just this stereotypical like bullshit around where a lot of like my grandmother, yeah, she's a Métis lady, she's in her 90s, she's not ceremonial, she loves her beadwork, don't get me wrong. She goes, but like she'll find her more at the casino, and she's having a few drinks, and she's hanging out, like she's talking shit all the time. Like she's not like living up to this like stereotypical trope of who like an indigenous like elder would be from a Western viewpoint, but she's living a contemporary existence, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like that's a beautiful thing. And I want my characters and like these books to be able to like, ca capture the nuance of it. Like not everyone has to be a warrior constantly like fighting for things. Like my cousins can, work for the power line company. They can be teachers. They don't all need to be someone that's like pedestaled by a Western like society in this new one, or falling into like old style stereotypes either. I'm trying to capture that a bit in the poetry as well.
Yeah, so you're writing short stories and obviously poetry, and then this latest book is a more traditionally formatted novel. And so I'm wondering about that process with you and how Do you find you need to get in different headspaces when you're sitting down? I'm going to write poetry now, or I'm going to write a novel now, or is it just like?
Yeah, I was actually like I was chatting with my friend this morning, and we were talking about the idea of like poetics and like what that comes like inspiration like kind of comes from that, you know. And I feel like poetry, you can be like walking down the road and like you'll see like, you know, a magpie carrying a chicken wing bone, and you're like, sweet magpie, chicken wing bone, like make a note of that. I'll write a poem about that later. Great image. Where with like fiction to me is a job. Like you need to like to create a continual like narrative and be within those characters' headspaces. You need to be working on it like on a daily basis, like sitting down for like, you know, a few hours and just writing and whatever comes from that, whether it's good or bad, but you need to be constantly imbibing within that space to like create well so you don't lose it. Like I feel like if I started writing something not like fiction wise and then took 6 months off and then came back, like it's not going to land. I need to be within that the entire time. Where poetry, like, you know, you can kind of come and go from it. And I find fiction to be a job. I like it, don't get me wrong. Like, but I find poetry to be fun. Like, that's more my vibe there. Like, I really like the idea of the creation of poetry, and also the idea of like I feel there's a lot of freedom in just like creating images. Like, you can be like giant crane walking through downtown Edmonton, you know, and like cool, like yeah, big bird. Where fiction, you gotta kind of think through those a few more, justify why there's a giant crane walking through downtown Edmonton.
I think you can feel that in your work. When I was reading Old Gods, the most of what I found was that it was really playful and like excited to be there and these sorts of things. But you were still able to, it felt elegiac in some ways and like mourning a past before colonialism and stuff like that too. But I think first the playfulness comes through. And I really appreciated that. But I think all three books have that sort of, not a dichotomy, but it's like a balance. In some ways, they're just loving life and having fun, all of your characters and narrators, and figuring out who they are as people and within relationships and everything else. But then there's an underlying sort of, yeah, anger and frustration with how things are compared to what they could be and all of that. Yeah, I wonder if you could speak to that sort of dichotomy.
I like the you know, like the use of humor is like a necessary thing to like be able to like get through an existence in any capacity. Like if you're gonna live a good life, you better be laughing a lot while you're doing so. And I feel like a lot of people, you know, like we funny people, we got like these jokes, we got these things that kind of like captured within this. So I love like, you know, I try to be able to like capture a humor within, you know, the writing that also is like paired or mirrored with like some of these actual like harder kind of like concepts that are being brought along with it. Like, you know, like in Avenue of Champions, like one of my favorite scenes is when he like gives the phone to or like the girl he's trying to impress, Cheryl, like gets his phone and she's like, what's your password? And he's like, and she's like looks at him and he's like, 6969. And she's like, wow, like nice, buddy. Like I thought that was just such a funny scene to write, or like writing out scenes while characters are playing crib. Like I think that's such a funny way of like writing, where they're like talking, like because we've if you play crib, you've all done this, where you're like having a conversation but like listing out like numbers at the same time, which if you don't know crib would make absolutely no sense, where you're like 15 for two, so how's so and so doing, 31, you know, and you're like naming these things as it goes. And like just bringing in that element of play, I guess, into like the writing a little bit as well. It's a fun way of approaching it. And I think like, you know, if I read a book and if I'm reading a book, I'm looking for those like instances of like joy that come with it. And I think like something like Avenue of Champions, maybe not so much, but Prairie Edge and Old Gods in particular, like I want like Old Gods, like the last poem, like what do you believe in? That poem is echoing a lot of old Métis concepts around like Louis Riel's like essentially like manifestos and like prophecies around like what he believes the future of being Métis in the prairies will look like that we're going to be saved not through, you know, trying to appeal to some fucking colonial government, but rather we're going to be saved by like the artists and the poets, you know, the beaters and the dancers. Like I forget my exact writing for it, but that essentially the arts are going to be able to things to save us, like listen to community voice and story and the arts and the writers, the poets. And it's like, and it's meant to end on like, you know, that there's like, even though there's a lot of negativity happening, that there is hope for the future. And we carry that hope for the future within our own stories and within our own communities. Same with like, you know, Prairie Edge, like in that last, I'm not sure if you finished it yet or not, but like the last, like, you know, that kind of conclusion is supposed to be like, almost like essentially like a dream state of what the prairies could look like under like a form of indigenous like governance run by like the matriarchs that we listen to there.
Well, I wonder if you want to read that last poem. That was one that really struck me, especially at the end of the book, that yeah, it really was hopeful and sort of illustrated a lot of what's going on throughout the collection. Would you be willing to read What Do You Believe In for us?
Yeah, absolutely. This is from Old Gods, and it's the last poem in the collection. What do you believe in? Do you believe in the ghosts of aunties and uncles that drive old single bench pickup trucks spotted with bullet hole rust, sweet grass and beaded necklaces dangling from the rear view mirror? Those who dream forever of empty stretches of prairie trail turned concrete road passed over by generations of everyone who held the memory of you close. Those who believed in you even when you didn't believe that the future could be infinite for all of us who live under and within endless sky, endless prairie wool, endless bison, and endless coveys of sharp-tailed grouse. Do you believe in sitting on the shores of the Saskatchewan River next to Nahewak cousins, planning out the moose hunts that will keep meat flowing back into a Miskatchewaskahegan for another winter so that all of our relations can taste the blood and body of a true Eucharist, the earth made whole through the eyes of a two-year-old bull moose, his flesh sustaining and forever nurturing our kinship spirits that only move us further toward understanding who we were always meant to be? Do you believe in the beauty of the wrinkles around an old lady's eyes while she sits wrapped up in a homemade quilt, sipping muskeg tea next to the wood-burning stove? Each line, a thousand laughs, a thousand tears, a thousand stories spilled out so that we can move forward in a good way, holding truth next to our hearts, sustained through the crackle of birch burning dark into the night, forever holding onto our place next to the grandmothers who defined what it means to be family. Do you believe in singing loud into the night, barn dances replaced by pubs and karaoke machines, potato champagne by cheap bottles of Pilsner? Oh no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll stay alive. Rippling through the air to the backdrop of fading fiddles, spoons, and the tapping of beer bottles on hard-top tables, cards swooshing as they're dealt high into the air. Bet on us because we're not going anywhere. Never were, never will. Gloria Gaynor had it right all along. Do you believe in those who aren't born yet? Those who will come after us? Those who will take back the land from the idea of Canada and give it away to the grasses, eradicate the machinery, tear it down, build it up. Believe in the words and the way that pride is written all over the faces of those who learn what it means to own ourselves, to never bow under hell on earth, to never step back, but always move forward, knowing that within this landscape, we are reborn, awoken, brought back by the artists and the writers, the poets and the dancers, the musicians and the lovers, the beaters and the hunters, because I do. I believe in everything.
Thanks. Yeah,
that I was, like that poem.
Me too. That was really beautiful. Thank you for doing that.
I wrote that poem initially for an organization called the Mamawe Collective that's out of Winnipeg, a Métis kind of community organizing group. And they were putting a zine together of Métis artists and writers and others who are doing interesting community-based organizing and work. And they asked me to contribute a poem. So that's where that one was. I created that poem for that. And and I really like it. I think it's one of my like favorite ones from the collection, actually.
Mm-hmm. I really do feel like it's sort of a microcosm of your larger work that I've read, these three books, in that it's really... the ways the other two novels discuss what might be compared to what is now. This is.
Yeah.
So continuing on with the genre talk, this is really interesting for me because it's hard for me. Like when I'm writing short fiction, I'm kind of reading short fiction and I'm like stuck in that mode. And then Same with novels. When I'm working on a novel now, and so I've been in this huge novel kick, trying to find books that are similar and stuff. And I don't write poetry, but I read it here and there. But I'm just wondering about your process there. You said when you're writing fiction, you can't spend time away from it. You need to be continuing in that fictional mode. Does this mean you're taking space to write poetry when you're writing poetry, and then you're taking space to write fiction when you're writing fiction? Or do they ever like blur, and it's just like, I need to get this out this way right now?
They definitely blur. Like, cause I feel like it's like, you know, that like when I'm doing fiction or writing fiction, I need to like be able to like sit down and like spend like a significant amount of time, like on a daily basis. Like I'm a man of routine. So I need to like be able to like really like get into a writing like habit. Like Avenue of Champions, you know, like I wrote most of that book from like the bathtub while I was like during the course of a winter, essentially. I was like, okay, sweet, like isolated like environment, like had my iPad and had a little thing that went across the bathtub, and I was like, perfect, I'll just write this book there. So, and like Prairie Edge, like same, I was just like taking time during the pandemic as well to like really just like spend time sitting with that and being able to work on it on a daily basis. But I feel like a lot of Old Gods kind of came at the same moment, you know, because I feel that's more like, yeah, like intuitive, like something will happen that I just want to write a poem about, or mm-hmm. something along those lines. Like, it's not necessarily, I don't think I ever plan any of that. And like, I have a current, another poetry collection that I'm finished, and it's a poetic novella following four Métis characters as they navigate their way through Edmonton. And we're currently in the process of trying to get that out there into the world. And, but you know, like that book came out of the last like couple months. I was just like working through that one, because this was like essentially another story that I wanted to make sure is there, tell there. So
can we talk about Prairie Edge a little bit?
Oh yeah.
I'm really intrigued and wondering where this idea came to release these wild bison into the middle of Edmonton. How did the whole thing come about for you?
Oh man, I read a news article maybe a decade ago now, where a herd of bison got loose from a farm somewhere outside of Camrose, Alberta, and were like stampeding around the town at like 5 a.m. And I thought that was just such a funny image to like have, like, you know, all these like a herd of bison, like say you're like, you know, going to work and it's early and it's a beautiful summer morning or whatever, and you're like going and grabbing your coffee and driving down like Main Street Camrose, and all of a sudden there's like 200 bison stampeding towards you. And I was like, oh yeah, that would be, what a funny like image or thought. And I think the, you know, the bison are a great like metaphor for essentially like prairie survival and like a return to like governance systems in general as well. Like the essentially like attempt to exterminate and extinguish the bison was like a direct attempt by, you know, the American and Canadian governments and British governments, and to eliminate and exterminate Indigenous peoples. Like they went hand in hand, the two things on the prairies here. And against like basically all odds, like the bison are here and they thrive and they will continue to thrive and only continue to like grow. Like they're the ultimate prairie animal. And like, I feel like the same thing goes with like the Indigenous communities in these spaces of the prairies in particular, is like, you know, they've attempted to get rid of all of us, and we're still here and we're not going anywhere and we never will. And I think the two really go hand in hand. And I thought like, also, like, I really wanted to kind of play around with the idea of like if we're returning to the idea of like a land governance structure, the idea of this concept, like land back, what does it look like in actual action? What does it look like with a return to a governance system? And what does it look like if there's a return to like, you know, having like, yeah, these bison is essentially a metaphor, like, but also them just in the space again too. So.
So that leads a little bit into my next question. I just wanted to sort of talk about the intent of this book. And I know authors have different ideas about, some aren't willing to speak to what they want the reader to find meaning, while others are, others do like to sort of talk about what they were trying to do. I wondered if you could answer that however you want. If you don't want to, then.
Oh no, no, I have no problem with that. I think like a lot of it is me, like I do a quite a bit of, you know, just someone who worked in like continues to work in like post-secondary and has for a while, like the amount of like kind of this like neoliberal attitude towards like indigenous peoples is just so pervasive and prevalent, where like, you know, this idea of like, oh, well, like, I'd love to learn more about who indigenous peoples are. And like, yeah, cool. There's like so much information out there. Like, you can just Google it at this point. You can read one of these books. Like, there's so much stuff out there. And there's so many people who like, you know, love the idea of supporting indigenous like peoples and protests and those kind of things. But then when there's something that's actually affecting their day-to-day livelihood or just their day-to-day life even, then it, like, that'll switches in a heartbeat. Yeah, sure. If you're like doing an Indigenous People's Day celebration, like, we'd love to attend that and watch the powwow dancing and the jigging and like see the fiddle music play, blah, blah, blah. But like, oh, wait, you actually want this land back for this park that we walk our dogs in? Like, hell no, absolutely not. And I thought that was funny to have like this idea of like, you know, these bison in these public spaces in Edmonton. But really this could just be in any city in like the world. And then, you know, like these people who are, they want to support Indigenous issues or whatever, not it, like they say issues, but you know, they want to support Indigenous peoples. But now that they, you know, there's bison there, they're like angry and they're pushing back against this idea. And I think that's just such a funny like contemporary take on neoliberalism. But I also wanted to kind of like showcase that, you know, there's a lot of like this book like essentially is like almost like a composite of a lot of these people I know who are like incredibly strong matriarchal community lead and two-spirit community leaders who like are really like the ones who push this, like these movements. They push things. They're doing all of the work. They are like constantly like, they do so much for communities, so much for like pushing movement. They do so much like incredible like activism and work, and then like some dude will sweep in and just be like, no, it's actually me that's doing it all, like give me the props. And so kind of making a little bit of a take on people who build like a brand or an image around like protesting or things like that, you know, like trying to almost become like famous or like the hypocrisy and like something along those lines. So I thought that was something I wanted to kind of explore too, like this like almost like patriarchal like colonial way of like co-opting protests to build like a brand, your own personal brand.
Well, that too leads into something else I wanted to talk about. In both novels, you're writing from the male protagonist's perspective, but you shift to female perspectives. In Avenue of Champions, it's mainly your granny, or the character's granny, and then and then here there's kind of two protagonists that go back and forth, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit because it feels seamless to me, but I'm wondering if how writing from a female perspective, was that difficult for you, or stuff like that? But also, why was it important? Maybe two questions here. Why was it important for you to have that female perspective? I mean, you spoke to it a little bit, but
I don't think I, like, honestly, like, I don't plan, like, I didn't really plan these books out, just kind of like went and rolled with it and seen what happened as I was writing it. And for the switch to like the perspective, I just felt like it was like a necessary take to kind of have that like thought process of like what this like looks like, and also show like the thing with the characters Gray and Prairie Edge and then Granny in Avenue of Champions is that they drive action. The male protagonists are like just a lot, like they're just, they're I wanted to like almost switch this idea of what you see with a lot of contemporary literature, and just like literature in general, where like the, like, you know, the female characters are just like, you know, willfully doting along behind the men, where instead in like these books, like Granny is, you know, driving the action in Avenue of Champions. But then in Prairie Edge, Gray is, you know, like she drives the action, like she's the one making decisions, she's the one who's driving action in like in that book and community there. And I thought that was like a very important thing to kind of show that, like, because that's honestly the way that like I interpret the world, is like the matriarchal characters in my like life, they drive like the action, they drive like the narrative of the future. And we just like along to help support in whatever way we like kind of can. So yeah, wanted to kind of do that. It was funny. So I just finished recording the audiobook and doing all the edits for Prairie Edge, and the producer for, so we have two different voices reading it, similar to like Avenue Champions. And the producer who was, or the engineer producer behind it, he heard me do all my recording first. So I did all the Ezzy chapters. And then a voice actor, Sarah, she did all the Gray parts. But he heard only me do mine, and he hadn't read the book. And then Sarah came and did hers. And he's like, he thought that was a really cool way to like hear the book play out, is by like hearing just like the Ezzy parts and then the Gray parts. Because he didn't know, like, you know, he's like, new things were happening, but he didn't know. And then he got all the context with like So he thought it was a very, I was like, ooh, maybe I'd play around with some formatting with this book for maybe something, and yeah, just mess around with it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I mean, now that you're saying it out loud, how they're the active characters, like, yeah, it really is in both. It seems the dudes kind of are in the background just doing their best to keep up.
Just
It's
doing their best.
really an interesting aspect there. I was also interested in Ezzie and Gray's relationship in the book. I've been thinking a lot about the ways Western storytelling is very, almost always revolving around romantic relationships. And in this story, there's hints at it that maybe each of them in some way might be interested in the other, but mostly they're just like pretty platonic friends that are working towards the same thing. And I wondered if you wanted to talk about that and why you chose not to have them as a couple or whatever.
I just think that's like almost what you're saying there. It's like tropey. It's just like kind of like what, that doesn't add anything to the narrative. And like it also kind of diminishes it. Like I just don't think that, like, I don't know. I just couldn't see someone like Gray being interested in a character like Ezzie either, in like a romantic kind of like sense. Like maybe, I don't know, but like I feel that in that, yeah, I just like don't, I think it's kind of tropey, honestly. And like to like build that up, and like not all, you don't always need that in a story. Like I tell some of my students in their short stories, like you don't always need your characters to like hook up. Like sometimes it's fine if they're just like friends and hanging out. You don't hook up with every single person you see in the world. So like that's not the way that it needs to work within your stories either. Yeah, so I don't know. I just like, I don't think I really actually honestly thought too much about ever having that as an option. I think I wanted to like discuss the potential of it at one point, which I did in that scene, just to kind of answer the idea of a read, like, you know, if some reader was like, well, why aren't they like banging? And I'm like, well, they don't need to be banging. Not everyone needs to be banging.
I do think it there's a power to a platonic friendship. It seems weird to say because most of our relationships are platonic friendships, but there's fewer stories that really explore that thing. And the fact that SC is mildly interested or even interested, but still is able to recognize that the friendship is more than that, and he's still like got her back all the way through and is like, I think that's a powerful relationship that if it were because he was interested romantically, it would diminish, like you were saying, it would diminish the whole thing. So I really just like that aspect of their whole relationship. I thought that was really cool.
I did like the one of my favorite things from I thought was funny in Prairie Edge was writing in about like catalytic, like how Ezzie makes a living stealing catalytic converters. That was like one of my favorite scenes. And then the ironic thing was that while I was writing that, my catalytic converter got stolen off of my vehicle. And I was like, oh yeah, that's fitting.
Brutal. I worked for a company. I work at the library now, but in 2022 and into 2023, I was working for a company, and we have these big 15-passenger vans that we haul clients around. And yeah, over the span of 2 months or whatever, I think five of those catalytic converters were stolen. It was this whole thing. We had to keep getting it replaced. It was really annoying, but yeah.
Most people I know don't even replace them anymore. In like a prairie city, they just like straight pipe it and then like pretend that they have them. No one knows.
All right. I think lastly, I wanted to shift from the work a little bit and into like your life a little bit if you're comfortable with this and how your work sort of reflects your writing in both novels and even Old Gods a little bit. Some of your characters have gone through the system, as it were, earning university degrees and getting jobs with the government, and early on they feel like they might be able to enact change and they're really really gung-ho and all of that, but then seem to eventually conclude that change is, if not impossible, then much less likely than they first imagined. And I wonder about your experience. I know you have a bachelor and an MFA, and you're now a prof and everything. I wonder if you'd like to speak to how you feel within the system, and if you can see change happening, or if it how much of it is just frustrating for you, or however you want to
Oh
talk
yeah.
about
No,
that.
I think it's like it's very much a it's a thrust. I mean, I think I heard a good thing from an elder a long time ago now. I believe it was Elder Bob Cardinal and Enoch that told me this, but he spoke about how like change isn't going to come. Like if we're waiting for like a Western system to enact change for an Indigenous community, we're going to be waiting for a long time. Like that's not where change comes from. Like change comes from community. It comes from like, you know, elders pushing back. It comes from youth pushing back. It comes from like honoring those voices and like those like long-term like community priorities to move towards like creating like change. It doesn't come from a government. Government policies are like redacted. They're in response to community like pressure, essentially. You know, like it's not, they're not going to be the things that actually solve it. Western-based education models aren't going to be the things that like solve it either. Like we all know at this point that that's not like the reality of what's going to like create a better future for Indigenous like peoples. Like throwing Band-Aid money and like Band-Aid like funding at things isn't going to happen either. You need to look at like systemic causes and systemic roots and like what that looks like to actually like create a better future. And I honestly, like, I find like a lot of I take a lot of pleasure and a lot of like, I have a lot of joy in like teaching generations of, well, not generations, but like a lot of young Indigenous, non-Indigenous, both students, as well as like a lot of students, especially in Edmonton, who are come from immigrant families who are quite new to Canada, whether they're Somalian, Ethiopian, Indian. And we often talk about within these classes, you know, how the forces of colonialism has affected all of us, like in particular and in general, and created these like situations where people have to come together. But in listening to the youth, their voices, their stories, like, honestly, even the way they support each other, like, I'm not sure how old you are, but like I was like, you know, in school in the 90s and like mid 2000s, or like 2000s, and like it was not a supportive place at that point. Like it was a very like, school was very, very different, and university was very, very different, where like I see the way that these like students like just engage with each other, and it seems to be so much more like supportive and like just friendly and like communicative than like I saw back in the day, which is, you know, it's a great way of seeing how like things are like progressing in a good space. And like even thinking about the way that like, you know, Indigenous, like the work with Indigenous communities and Indigenous communities and their priorities have come in the last, you know, yeah, like it's been a long struggle, but it's been community that's directed that and pushed back against everything. Like it's not like the governments and the like post-secondaries and the institutions in general are not the ones that like have like created the beauty that we find within Indigenous communities today. It's the, and the prosperity. And that might not look like the Western model of financial prosperity, but there is prosperity there, and there's beauty there, mm-hmm. there's culture there, but it comes from directly from the community, not from an institution. So I'm like very much of the opinion, you know, that like we need to be able to support these voices and support youth and building up their own like skill set so that they're able to have the space to be able to share their knowledges and share their priorities for the future. Like what the hell am I going to tell like the youth what they want to do for their like future and their jobs or anything like that, you know? Like I don't know, but they do. And so we need to like properly like listen to them and think, you know, within a 7-generation base thinking, where we're looking not just for like the kids who are going to come afterwards or the kids are going to come after, but what does the prairie look like 7 generations from now, and what will make that a safe space for everybody to live in a good way? And we're not going to get there if we don't return to Indigenous governance structures and we keep going with our current colonial ones. We're not going to be here in 7 generations to see what the prairie is going to look like. So we need to make sure that we're returning it in a good way where we're reciprocal in our relationships to both, you know, our ancestors, future generations, each other, as well as to the land itself, to the animals, the birds, everything that comes with that too. So I could talk a lot about that. Yeah, but I hope that my writing, you know, with like Prairie Edge, with Old Gods, even Avenue of Champions, this new book, once we get it out there, a lot of that's like kind of addressed within it too, you know, and that the community voice sings loud at the end of the day. Mm.
Well, my last question is one that I've started to ask authors at the end of these things. And that is there anything or any aspect of your work that you wish people would ask you about? Like, is there a question you wish someone would ask you about your work that you want to talk Ooh. About?
I don't know, actually. That's a good question. But I feel like, I don't know. I feel like I get it covered because I just honestly just ramble on most of the time anyway. So I kind of just hit the topics I want to. Like the Catholic converter thing. I do like, you know, like the integration of like small little like symbols within a lot of the work that like I call it like my almost like Easter eggs, you know, like my the little hidden things that a lot of people like they read and they're just like, oh, you know, like I got like funny group chat names like embedded within stories or within like poem, like in some way whatsoever. Like I'll put in, you know, culture, a lot of cultural references that are very subtle. And like, you wouldn't pick them up. I also love the way of like, most people would not pick them up whatsoever. And then the odd person would be like, oh, I got that one. And then it's like love writing and like, and I think this is where I really like, you know, I appreciate a book that actually like writes in what a contemporary experience looks like in terms of like the dialogue, ways people talk to each other, ways people engage through like text, you know, through video games, like through other games, like those kind of things. I think we need to be very conscious of the way that like people actually truly engage in a communicate in a modern world and not like shy away from writing in what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. All right. So moving into the penultimate segment, I had a bit of a tricky time coming up with things here because many of my past interviewees, I know at least parasocially through social media, TikTok and other things, I know some of the things they're interested in. But of course, we've never met. I don't know much about who you are outside of your writing. So I picked out from the books that maybe you were possibly a hockey fan and maybe particularly an Oilers fan. Would I be correct in suggesting that?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I would say, but very much so. Yeah. I got this great photo of me, you know, in full on like Oilers, like hockey gear when I'm like 6 years old. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what I was going to ask. I guess first, if it were true that you are an Oilers fan, when did this whole
as long as I can remember. Yeah.
And so, are you kind of a diehard fan? Like, I am also an Oilers fan. My partner is an Oilers fan. Her stepdad is like diehard.
I wouldn't say I'm diehard. Yeah. I like hanging out with my friends, like watching the game here and there, like going to games, doing that. I watch all the playoff games, but like. My buddy who lives with me, like, and our other friend, like, they'll quote stats from like the 90s, you know, like weird thing. Like, I can't do that. I probably couldn't name the full roster right now, you know, but like, I'll watch. Yeah.
I have another buddy who's a big Oilers fan. He lives in outside of Toronto, but he has like ideas of who they should have drafted and who they should trade for and everything. But I'm just like, I'll watch the game. Connor McDavid.
I'm cool. I'm the same vibe there. I would never, I don't read like articles. I don't go like in depth on it kind of thing. Yeah.
And so do you think this year's version of the Oilers has it in them?
I hope so because my buddy and I, like we have a lot of tickets this year. So I'm like very like, would like to go to a playoff game. Yeah. That's for sure. I like the vibe though. Like I like going for the part. I'm a sheep. I love like being a part of like a crowd, you know, like a big, like I love a crowd mentality and a mob mentality. So I'm like very, very happy. I want to go and like be in like a big, like environment like that. I find it funny. I also think like hockey culture is like the absolute worst thing. Mm-hmm. I love the game and like watching it and of course cheering for the Oilers, but like I just think like Canadian hockey culture is so toxic. But it doesn't need to be. That's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It could be better. Yeah.
I think that's the appeal for me with hockey, but sports in general, cheering alongside a crowd of strangers that more than likely I have nothing in common with other than our joined love for this one team, and it feels like that mob mentality or that crowd, we're all cheering for something, when even the years when there's one Canadian team left in the playoffs and it seems like the whole country is cheering for that one team. Like the year Calgary almost won it, that's many years ago now. Or even the year Edmonton was in, was that 2000?
Yeah, 06.
Or 06.
06. Calgary was 04. Edmonton was 06. And I was in grade 12. Oh, and me and all my buddies were going to, we were driving the White Avenue to walk around and like just check out the chaos that was happening. It was so fun. Yeah. And I remember I ironically had hair at the time and was going to shave my head if the Oilers won the Stanley Cup, made that bet, and they lost. So didn't have to. Oh. But 5 years later, I was shaving my head anyway, so it didn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the chaos of playoff wins, or when the Like for us here, it's only the Rough Riders that we can compare to that.
Yeah.
Like, but even like I don't watch CFL really unless the Riders are in the Grey Cup.
Yeah.
But the year we won in 2013 or whatever it was the last time, everyone went downtown. Like,
Yeah, Taylor
and
Street was bumping.
again, all these people that I have almost nothing in common with, but we're all just like jumping around and cheering and hugging each other, and I like that
Yeah.
shit.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe when the Bison actually get released in Edmonton at some point, people will be cheering and like that when they're stampeding down Jasper Avenue.
Yeah.
Probably not, but yeah.
The other day I met an unhoused person outside of the library. I work at the library downtown. And he came up to me, he introduced himself. He's like, "Hey, my name's yada yada, I can't remember. And I predict the Leafs will beat the Ducks in the Stanley Cup Final 4-1."
Nice,
That
he had it ready.
was his intro. And I'm like, "Are you a Leafs fan?" He's like, "No, I hate the Leafs. I'm a Habs fan." And I was like, "Oh, well,
Yeah.
good for you to be objective about this." But
Yeah, totally.
it's kind of
Yeah.
funny.
That
Do
is
you
funny. Yeah.
have a prediction of who's going to win the cup this year?
Well, obviously I would like Oilers over I would love for the Oilers to just like absolutely destroy the Maple Leafs. Because I would love needling people about that, but I also like don't think the Maple Leafs would be anywhere even near a final. So it would be like Oilers over like Carolina in like five games. That would be it.
I would like a revisit.
Repeat of 06. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking I would like a repeat of 1994. Oh no, that's the Canucks. Well, that could happen too. I'm not a Canucks fan. They're one of my worst teams. But in 94, they were playing the Rangers, and my buddy at school, if you can call him that, he was cheering for the Rangers just because he knew I was back then. I was like a diehard Canucks fan, and I had gear and stuff. And yeah, when they lost in game seven, he called within like 30 seconds of the game ending, and he's just like, ha, "The Rangers, Canucks suck."
That would be the
So
kind of thing I would do.
I've always wanted the Rangers to lose in the finals, but yeah,
Maybe they'll lose Edmonton
that
this year. You never know.
so that's a 30-year thing I've been holding on to. Yeah.
Nice.
Really healthy.
Yeah.
All right, so our final segment is what I call friends off or on. I think I'm gonna start moving away from the friends off books because there's a lot of repeat books. But if you have some friends off books, I'd love to hear them. But if you just want to focus on friends on, that's cool too.
So what are we doing? Like books you like kind of thing?
Yeah,
That's
for
the vibe?
friends off, it started because I made some TikTok videos that were pretty popular, like hundreds of thousands of views. I said, if you tell me this book is your favorite book, it's friends off. And it was like Jordan Peterson. I think I included
Oh, I
Harry
get it.
Potter once. And
So it's like someone's telling you this, like, you'd be like,
yeah,
yeah, I get it.
so like I meet you for the first time, we somehow get talking about books, and you're like, "Oh, I really love Atlas Shrugged." Then I'm like, "Well, I'm not going to be your friend." And people liked it, but other people were pissed off. "Oh, how pretentious! So you just let people enjoy stuff, you know?" And I'm like, "It's just a bit for TikTok, but there's truth to it too." So.
There's this funny podcast where they like apps like this I forget what it's called off the top of my head. It's a very popular podcast, and they like dissect like these really crappy like books, usually like nonfiction books, and like go through it, these two friends. But they
Is it
reminded me because sorry, go ahead.
books can kill or something? Books can,
Maybe that sounds about right.
yeah. I
Like
think
and
I've heard about
but
it, but I haven't listened to it.
it's good. I was really enjoying reading it, but they've talked about this book and definitely friends off for me because I remember because it was a very popular book when I was in like high school and at the end of high school, and it was called The Game by Neil Strauss, and it's all about objectifying women essentially, and it was so fucking bad. And they were talking about that book on that podcast recently, and I totally spaced on it, and they brought it back. I was like, oh, I remember that. But if anyone had ever like mentioned that book to me, I'd be like, I'm like I'm not a fighter, but I might fight them, like straight up. But like friends on, like my favorite books that I'm reading right now, I like anything by Colson Whitehead.
Okay.
He's such an incredible writer. And it was American there, out of like New York, but like his writing is just like so cool, with Crook Manifesto as well as Harlem Shuffle, like just incredible, incredible books. I really obviously like a lot of, oh, you know what book I recently read? It was on Canada Reads, so it doesn't need any more like publicity than I got, but it was incredible. It's one of the, I think one of the most beautiful books I've read in a long time was Denison Avenue.
Mm. I picked that one up because of Canada Reads, but I haven't read it yet. Yeah.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's like hauntingly beautiful how like that story and just like the story of love, but also gentrification of like Chinatown and Toronto here, as well as like just the like the genre bending between like poetry and fiction, as well as like I love like a graphic art, like a artist like streetscape style of like a city. And Daniel, the co-contributor to the book, like drew all these incredibly beautiful like sketches of Toronto in the back of it, and it's just so like in neighborhoods and specific like streetscapes, and it's just like it's such a beautiful book. Like I can't stop talking about it, but I'm talking to everyone about like I was in my like class the other day and I was like, you all better read Denison Avenue when you're off this summer, it's so great, and blah blah blah, and like yeah, that book, I love that book. Yeah,
cool. That was pretty awesome how Jessica Jones was part of that. Hey.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Bad Curry is an exceptional book, and, and Jessica's an exceptional, exceptional writer. And I feel very honored that I get to spend time with them on a regular basis and just hear their writing and like, and yeah, hear their voice. So
she came on my pod just like days before I heard that her book was part of the thing. So I kind of wished I had waited a week or something so that we could talk about that a little
bit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's probably all right,
was,
though, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really happy to see the book as part of Canada Reads because I
totally me too.
Such an interesting book. But
yeah.
So I guess that's the conclusion of our interview. Thank you again so much for coming. Oh, so much for coming on.
That was great.
I was really looking forward ever since you said yes to come on. I went back and forth from really excited to kind of nervous to really excited to kind of nervous, but.
Yeah. Thanks for reading through the books and promoting them as well and everything like that. And that beautiful introduction making me blush and all of that. It's good. Thank you for the conversation, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you for coming on. And hopefully our paths will cross sooner than later.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Okay. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good rest of your weekend here.
Yeah, you too.